Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And now on to New Yorkers' favorite topic, real estate. We've all heard about the softening market and how it's a different world now for real estate developers than it was during boom times a few years ago. But what you don't hear about as much is what it's like for affordable housing developers in this new market. And despite the soft market, the mayor insists that
we're not cutting back. We're not turning back. We are still on course to hit our affordable housing targets on time.
Mayor Bloomberg used to be all about tacking on affordable housing to larger for-profit residential developments through tax breaks and subsidies. Now he's turned his attention more towards preservation. Joining me now are two guests central to the development and preservation of affordable housing in the city, Rafael Sestero, the commissioner of the Department of Housing Preservation and Development, and Ron Molas, co-founder and vice chairman of the New York State Association for Affordable Housing, a nonprofit housing policy advocate. He's also the CEO of L&M Development Partners, an affordable housing developer. Welcome back to both of you. Hi.
Hi.
Good morning.
And Ron Molas, tomorrow is the annual New York State Affordable Housing Conference, organized by your group, the New York State Association for Affordable Housing. How different will the conversation at the conference be this year from, say, 3 years ago?
Thanks, Brian. I think the conference is actually going to be better attended than ever before. We probably have a 20% increase, so we expect about 1,500 people. And We have a number of panels, and there's a lot going on. I think the difference is going to be the focus will be on the preservation and the distress in the marketplace, especially in the multifamily marketplace, and how those present opportunities in the affordable housing arena. And the second aspect of it is the fact that there is credit available for affordable housing, both from terms of the city providing dollars and the lenders providing money. And I think there'll be conversations, even though the credit is tighter, as to how that money gets used.
So I think we can agree that it's harder to develop for-profit housing in the city right now than it used to be a couple of years ago. Credit is harder to come by. Developers aren't as confident that they can sell high and sell quickly. Is it that much harder for affordable housing developers? How closely does the affordable housing industry track with a for-profit or even luxury real estate industry?
I think the affordable housing industry in some ways is countercyclical to the market. And there are advantages in our industry when the market is good. Obviously, there's some benefits to that. But when the market is in the state it's in now, the affordable housing industry has been flourishing in some ways. We've been busier than ever. And one of the in light of all the regulatory issues going on in Washington now, one of the ironic things is the CRA legislation, which was passed 30 years ago in effort to encourage banks to lend in poor neighborhoods, has now become a driving force for credit in the marketplace. And one of the few places banks are lending is in the affordable housing arena, primarily because they're good investments and good loans.
Commissioner, is advocating for affordable housing a harder or easier sell in this new economy? I mean, before the argument was, well, developers are making tons of money in a very hospitable development environment under the Bloomberg administration, so they can afford to offer some of those units at affordable rates, what was sometimes called inclusionary zoning. Now I imagine the argument is more about the fact that the need is more evident, with unemployment still hovering around 10% in the city. So is it a harder or an easier sell to get affordable housing funded and built?
You know, Brian, thanks for having us on. And I think, you know, in a couple of ways, it's actually a little bit of both, which is the irony of it. It's a harder sell because as Ron pointed out, the credit is available for affordable housing. Banks are looking much more closely at transactions and individual projects, and it's harder to get through the credit chain at banks, which makes it harder to advocate within those banks for affordable housing. But at the same time, as you pointed out, the economy, the impact on families, the impact on neighborhoods makes the work that we're doing all that more important. And that's why, you know, we've continued to plow ahead and really thought creatively about how we can work with the affordable housing industry and with organizations like NYSAFA to take advantage of the opportunities that present themselves so that we can continue to create and preserve affordable housing in all five boroughs. And that also has the silver lining of creating jobs and showing economic activity in neighborhoods that are hardest hit by the economic downturn, and that's what we're doing across the city in all five boroughs.
Listeners, so many of you are looking for affordable housing. I'm sure many people have questions for the HPD commissioner, Rafael Sestero, or Ron Molas, the co-founder of NYSAFA, the New York State Association for Affordable Housing, 212-433-WNYC. You can call us up right now on affordable housing post-housing bubble, 212-433-9692. And by the way, Ron, I've been using the terms for-profit versus affordable housing. Is that technically accurate? I mean, you know, there's, of course, so much luxury development that was taking place in the city, obviously for-profit. Does all affordable housing have to be not-for-profit? Can't you make money building affordable housing?
Yeah, no, that's actually not. You're right. The term maybe market rate housing is a better term than for profit, because those of us who are in the business of building affordable housing, we do take risk and we do put up equity and raise money and we do make money or try to make money in the business. It's a different methodology to it. But even the nonprofits who are in the affordable housing business run their development companies as a business, and that's how they sustain themselves. So I think I like to look at affordable housing as double bottom line, but there should be a double bottom line. You should be able to do good and make money at the same time.
Brian, this is a really important point, and you and I talked the last time I was on the show about the inclusionary zoning program and some of the changes that we're making away from it. And I made the point at that time that the inclusionary zoning program was a really important innovation, but at the end of the day, it was not the bulk of the way in which we're creating or preserving affordable housing in New York. And the point that Ron makes is what makes New York unique. We have a real industry of both for-profit and non-profit affordable housing developers that have made their businesses about making New York City's neighborhoods more affordable, and that's how what enables us to do so much. That's what enables us in good times and in bad to start the construction of thousands and thousands of units every single year, because we have capable and competent partners, some that are doing it for profit and some that are not for profit, that can work with us and have built their businesses around this industry. It is truly unique from other parts of the country.
Let's take a phone call, and our lines, as you might imagine, immediately filled up when we put out the offer, and Ephraim in Brooklyn is calling in. Ephraim, thanks for calling. You're on WNYC.
Hi. First of all, I have one question and one comment. My question is about the term affordable. It's a widely used term, and I've never heard a definition of the word affordable, and my understanding, it's very relative. What is affordable for me is not affordable for somebody else, and vice versa. So if somebody can provide a definition to understand what we're talking about.
Good question. Always good to go back to that basic point. And, Commissioner, there are actual definitions at the policy level having to do with different incomes, correct?
That's right. So, Brian, your caller asked the single most often asked question that I get, which is, what do you actually mean by affordable housing? For us, in the mayor's housing plan, 165,000 units, to date, about 78% of everything we've done. Rents are set so that tenants pay no more than 30% of their income, and the income that we target is below 60% of the area median income. So in real terms, what does that mean? That means a family of four making about $45,000 a year can afford 78% of the housing that we have built. We also have built, the balance of that has been a mix. About 10% has been for moderate income families, and that's more like a family of four that earns between $75,000 and $85,000 a year, paying 30% of their income in rent, and the balance of it is for middle income families, which is more in the range of $100,000 to $110,000 a year for a family of four. That's how we define affordability. But the other key part of that is that the rents are set and the sales prices in home ownership projects are set so that people in those income ranges are not paying more than 30% of their income towards rent or mortgage payments.
And then the next question would be, who actually gets these apartments? And Melissa in Crown Heights is going to help launch that discussion. Melissa, how are you?
Hi, how are you? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually had applied for a purchase of a first-time home buyer under the HPD, and I got through the housing lottery. I got to a certain stage in the game, but I'm a freelancer, and when it actually came down to trying to get through the system, they had no idea how to deal with my income. I qualified as a low-tier single homeowner, but when it came time to proving that I actually could afford to pay for it, they said, oh, no, you can't pay for it, because the whole system isn't set up for anyone who doesn't have a W-2. And I'm wondering if, I would have loved to buy an apartment, and can this change for freelancers? How can we can't afford anything except rent?
Melissa, I'm so glad you called, because, Commissioner, we have, so many listeners to this program, like Melissa in Crown Heights, who are freelancers. That's how they can often listen at this time of day. So this is really a very common question. If they don't have the steady income of a regular paycheck and income fluctuates like a freelancer's would, do they automatically get locked out of all these affordable housing programs?
So, Brian, this is a great question, and Melissa, I really appreciate your call, because what it does is it points out what is, I would argue, the single biggest difference between the hot market where credit was flowing during 2005, 2006, and today's market. In the market in 2005, 2006, it was much easier for us at HPD and for people like Melissa to get through the lottery system to qualify for an apartment from the HPD perspective, but it was much easier for them to go and find a mortgage product that they could qualify for. In today's market, not only people like Melissa, but many, many others, people with regular incomes, with W-2s, who normally would qualify, are having a very hard time qualifying for mortgages. And the ability for us to get end loans to people like Melissa is one of the things that has been one of the biggest challenges. We're very lucky in New York because we have the state mortgage insurance company, Sunny Mae, which does provide mortgage insurance. And I know that the state is looking at a number of different ways in which it can help get banks more comfortable making loans. And the unfortunate reality for freelancers and people like Melissa is that in today's credit environment, it's going to be even harder than it was, 4 or 5 years ago to get that end loan mortgage. And we've got to figure out ways to help do that.
Melissa, good luck out there. My guess, if you're just joining us as we talk about affordable housing in New York City after the housing bubble, Ron Molis, co-founder and vice chairman of the New York State Association of Affordable Housing, a nonprofit housing policy advocate. He's also CEO of L&M Development Partners, an affordable housing developer, and Raphael Sestero, who is just speaking, the commissioner of the New York City Department of Housing Preservation and Development. And Ron Molis, I want to ask you, as a developer of affordable housing, does this new focus toward preservation that the city is emphasizing rather than new development hurt your business? Because you're an advocate, but you're also a developer who's benefited from the city's pro-development stance over the years. How is your business affected by this new marketplace and the new city agenda focusing on preservation of existing affordable units?
Well, that's a good question. We are still working on new development. It's getting a little more challenging for a variety of reasons, some of which Commissioner Sestero mentioned. But we've closed seven or eight new development construction loans in the past 18 months since the Lehman crisis occurred. So there is still enough activity there that our business is active. The preservation and focus on distressed properties and preservation of existing affordable is an area that we're looking to get more into. It's becoming more opportunistic. Being in this business requires change of the way you look at things, and we're doing that. It's a different aspect to a similar business, and I think the fact that there is not a lot of crazy money chasing the same properties that were doing so a few years ago leads an opportunity to responsible ownership and people like ourselves to get into preservation and distress multifamily and do it the right way.
Let's take another call. Paula in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I'm calling concerning the preservation issue. I live in a rent-stabilized apartment, and I think that a lot of the reason we need so much affordable housing is because the rent-stabilized stuff has been decimated over the years with legislation that isn't pro-rent-stabilized friendly. My rent went up 3%, whereas my daughter, who lives in a luxury deregulated rental, was able to renegotiate her rent for $300 less than she was paying. So I have to question, why is my rent-stabilized rent going up in a year when everyone who's not stabilized is renegotiating for lower rents?
Commissioner?
So I think there's a couple of things that are at play here. The first thing I would say is that, over the course of the last 8 years, on a net basis, there has been a significant loss of rent-stabilized stock. What I think is important, though, is that that loss of that stock is exactly why we embarked on the largest municipal affordable housing plan in the country. And from 2005 to 2008, with all of the units coming online through the new housing marketplace plan, that loss of units, rent-stabilized units with rents that were affordable to people earning below the median income, actually was arrested, and there was a slight increase in the number of units because every unit we produce or every unit we preserve is rent-stabilized.
But does that mean that the city is having to do backfill on the holes in the affordable housing safety net that the state is creating? Because, as you probably know, a whole bunch of tenant advocates went up to Albany yesterday to ask for repeal of vacancy decontrol. That's the rule where apartments are no longer under rent stabilization if it goes above $2,000 a month and turns over to a new tenant. So what's your feeling on repealing vacancy decontrol, or in general getting the state to change its laws so you don't have to backfill the leaks that they're creating?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. One is, I think you have to recognize that rent stabilization is a control over rents in the city that works in a much larger market, and it's about a million units on the roughly 2.5 million rental units that are in the city, and changing that system needs to be done in a way that reflects and is thoughtful about how that then impacts everybody else in the city and everybody else in the system. So I think that's a complicated discussion. It's one that the state is going to take up. I was actually in Albany on a separate set of matters yesterday as well when everybody was up there. It's clearly an issue of importance. But I think the thing that is a real opportunity as well today is the fact that many of the owners that were coming into the marketplace that were buying rent-stabilized units and were aggressively trying to move rents within the rent-stabilized system to vacancy decontrol are owners that are now finding that those business plans haven't worked. And we have an enormous opportunity right now to move good, solid quality owners of rent stabilized housing that have been the backbone of the city's rental stock for many years into ownership positions as the owners with the failed business plans move out of those buildings through foreclosure or through other means. And that's something that we're very focused on. It's something that I think people like Ron and his organization see as an opportunity because they were priced out of the market in private rent stabilized housing during the boom years, and they were not able to compete. And I think now we have an opportunity to help facilitate them. The changing of the law, the discussion about what happens with rent regulation is going to happen over the course of the next several months and year in Albany, and it's going to be something that's going to have to be looked at carefully.
Ron, as a developer of affordable housing, does anybody build rent-stabilized housing anymore, or is affordable housing that's new all in other kinds of programs?
No, almost I think all affordable housing that we're building is rent-stabilized, and not only I think the big difference, it's rent-stabilized, it's also subject to regulatory, so it's not only rent-restricted but income-restricted as opposed to general rent stabilization, which has no means test.
And Commissioner, having some perspective now on the back end of a housing bust, do you think it was not perhaps wise in retrospect to tie affordable housing development to market development, given the boom and bust cycle of the housing market?
No, actually, Brian, I think the opposite. I think that throughout New York's history of affordable housing, we have created a series of innovations that have stood the test of time. I think the market innovations that we created under the first half of the new housing marketplace plan, inclusionary zoning, the changes to the 421A program, while not producing a large number of units now during the down period, are still going to be in place when the market comes back. And so while we've had to adjust our strategies for achieving our goals around 165,000 units and have done that and will achieve that number, those programs are going to last. They're going to be here 10 years from now, and we're going to be able to get affordable housing created 10 years from now because of those innovations.
We're out of time, but Commissioner, just tell our listeners where they should start looking if they want to get a comprehensive list of affordable housing programs currently administered by the Bloomberg administration for people who are actually looking for affordable housing.
Absolutely. Two things they can do. They can call 311 and they will get routed to HPD, or they can go to nyc.gov, and on the very first opening page on the right-hand column, they can click on a link that says find affordable housing, and they can get access to a database of everything that is currently in lease up now.
And Ron Molis, real quick, are there hot neighborhoods for affordable housing development right now, ones that your group is building in primarily?
Yeah, we actually have some home ownership affordable units in Harlem, and we're doing some. We have some in the Bronx, in the Melrose section of the Bronx, and we're doing work in Cobble Hill and in Williamsburg, and have affordable housing in those neighborhoods as well as Brownsville and Bed-Stuy. So,
should people contact your organization directly, or just go through the means that the commissioner just said?
Well, there's obviously a lot more through the HPD, but we have our own website. LMDevPartners.com, and feel free to access that and try to and contact our marketing staff as well.
LMDev, letter L, letter M, Dev, D-E-V, dot?
LMDevPartners.
Partners.com. That's LNM Development Partners, an affordable housing developer. Ron Molis is the CEO. He's also co-founder and vice chairman of a nonprofit housing policy advocacy group called NYSAFA, the New York State Association for Affordable Housing. And Rafael Sestero is the commissioner of the Department of Housing and Preservation, Housing Preservation and Development. Thank you both so much. This is very useful to a lot of people.
Thanks very much, Brian, as always. Thank
Brian
you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up in a minute, we will check in with some developments out of the Supreme Court, both today, this morning, and yesterday. And then we will have some clips from a new play and a related call-in on how your parents told you about their divorce and what object was the most contested object in the divorce. So stay with us.